whose other end was tied around a tree, while Patty had jumped and jumped. On her way home from work today, Patty would stop by her mother's house. "You'll never guess who I saw," she'd say. The boy on the dock stood up, holding a yellow pail in one hand, a knife in the other. A seagull swooped in, and the boy waved his arm with the knife. Kevin watched as the boy turned to come up the ramp, but a man was sauntering down onto the wharf.
"Son, put the knife in the pail,"
the man called out, and the boy did that, carefully, and then grabbed the rail and climbed up the ramp to meet his father. He was still young enough that he took the man's hand. Together they peered into the pail, and then they got into the truck and drove off. Kevin, watching all this from his car, thought, good. And what he meant was that he had felt no emotion watching this, the man and the son.
"A lot of people don't have families," Dr. Goldstein had said, scratching his white beard, then unabashedly brushing away anything that had fallen onto his chest. "But they still have homes,"
folding his hands calmly across his big stomach. On his way here to the marina, Kevin had driven past his childhood home. The road was still dirt with deep ruts, but there were a few new homes tucked back into the woods. Tree trunks should have doubled in girth, and perhaps they had, but the woods remained as he remembered them, thick and tangled and rough, an uneven patch of sky showing through as he turned up the hill to where his house was. It was the shed that made him certain he'd not taken a wrong turn, the deep red shed beside the house, and right next to that, the granite rock that had been large enough that Kevin used to think of it as a mountain as he climbed it in his little boy sneakers. The rock was still there, and the house, but it had been renovated, a wraparound front porch added and the old kitchen gone. Of course, they'd have wanted the kitchen gone. A sense of umbrage pricked him, then left. He slowed the car, peering carefully for any signs of children. He saw no bicycles, no swing set, no treehouse, no basketball hoop. Just a hanging pink impatience plant by the front door.
This is disc number 2.
He slowed the car, peering carefully for any signs of children. He saw no bicycles, no swing set, no treehouse, no basketball hoop. Just a hanging pink impatience plant by the front door. Relief came, arriving as a sensation beneath his ribs, like a gentle lapping of the water's edge at low tide, a comforting quiescence. In the back of the car was a blanket, and he would still use it, even if there were no children in the house. Right now, the blanket was wrapped around the rifle, but when he returned, soon, while this relief still touched quietly the inner blankness he had felt on the long ride up, he would lie down on the pine needles and put the blanket over him. If it was the man of the house who found him, so what? The woman who had hung the pink impatience? She wouldn't look for long. But to have a child? No. Kevin could not abide the thought of any child discovering what he had discovered, that his mother's need to devour her life had been so huge and urgent as to spray remnants of corporeality across the kitchen cupboards. Never mind, his mind said to him quietly as he drove on past. Never mind. The woods were there, and that's all he wanted, to lie on the pine needles, touch the thin, ripping bark of a cedar tree, have the hackmatack needles above his head, the wild lilies of the valley with their green open leaves near him, the hidden white star flowers, the wild violets his mother had shown him, all these. The extra noise of the clanking sailboat masts made him realize the wind had picked up. The seagulls had stopped their squawking now that the fish entrails were gone. A fat gull that had been standing on the rail of the ramp not far from him took off, its wings flapping only twice before the breeze carried it along. Hollow-boned,
Kevin had seen gull bones as a child out on Puckerbrush Island. He had shouted with panic when his brother had collected some to take back to the house. "Leave them where they are," Kevin had shouted.
"States and traits," Dr. Goldstein had said. "Traits don't change. States of mind do."
Two cars drove in and parked near the marina. He hadn't thought there would be so much activity here on a weekday, but it was almost July and people had their boats to sail. He watched a couple, not much older than he was, take a big basket down the ramp, which already, with the tide coming in, was not so steep. And then the screen door of the diner opened, and a woman came out, wearing a skirt that went well over her knees, as well as an apron. She could have stepped out of a different century. She had a metal pail in her hand, and as she moved toward the dock, he watched her shoulders, the long back, her thin hips as she moved. She was lovely, the way a sapling might be as the afternoon sun moved over it. A yearning stirred in him that was not sexual, but a kind of reaching toward her simplicity of form. He looked away, and his body jumped a little to see a woman staring through the passenger window, her face close, staring straight at him. Mrs. Kittredge. Holy shit. She looked exactly the same as she had in the classroom in seventh grade, that forthright, high-cheek-boned expression. Her hair was still dark. He had liked her. Not everyone had. He would have waved her away now or started the car, but the memory of respect held him back. She wrapped her hand on the glass, and after hesitating, he leaned and unrolled the window the rest of the way.
"Kevin Coulson. Hello."
He nodded.
"You're going to invite me to sit in your car?"
His hands made fists in his lap. He started to shake his head.
"No, I'm only..."
But she had already let herself in, a big woman taking up the whole bucket seat, her knees close to the dashboard. She hauled a big black handbag across her lap.
"What brings you here?"
she asked. He looked out toward the water. The young woman was moving back up from the dock. The seagulls were screeching furiously behind her, beating their large wings and darting down. She'd have been throwing out clamshells, most likely.
"Visiting?"
Mrs. Kittredge prompted.
"From New York City? Isn't that where you live now?"
"Jesus,"
Kevin said quietly.
"Does everybody know everything?"
"Oh, sure," she said comfortably. "What else is there to do?"
She had her face turned to him, but he didn't want to meet her eyes. The wind on the bay seemed to be picking up more. He put his hands into his pockets so as not to suck on his knuckles.
"Get a lot of tourists now," Mrs. Kittredge said, "crawling all over the place this time of year."
He made a sound in his throat, acknowledging not the fact, what did he care, but that she had spoken to him. He watched the slim woman with the pail, her head tilted down as she went back inside, closing the screen door carefully.
"That's Patty Howe," Mrs. Kittredge said. "Remember her? Patty Crane. She married the older Howe boy. Nice girl. She keeps having miscarriages, and it makes her sad."
Olive Kittredge sighed, rearranged her feet, pushed the lever, much to Kevin's surprise, to make herself more comfortable, moving the seat back.
"I suspect they'll get her fixed up one of these days, and then she'll be pregnant with triplets."
Kevin took his hands from his pockets, cracked his knuckles.
"Patty was nice," he said. "I had forgotten about Patty."
"She's still nice. That's what I said. What are you doing in New York?"
"Oh."
He raised a hand, saw the reddened marks that spotted them, crossed his arms.
"I'm in training. I got my medical degree 4 years ago."
"Say, that's impressive. What kind of doctor are you training to be?"
He looked at the dashboard, couldn't believe he hadn't noticed the filth of it. There in the sunlight, it seemed to be telling her he was a slob, pathetic, not a shred of dignity. He took in a breath and said,
"Psychiatry." He expected her to say, "Ah." And when she said nothing, he glanced at her and found that she was giving a simple, matter-of-fact nod.
"It's beautiful here," he said, squinting back toward the bay.
The remark held gratitude for what he felt was her discretion, and it was true as well for the bay, which he seemed to view from behind a large pane of glass, larger than the windshield, and which did have, he understood, a kind of splendor, the twanging, rocking sailboats, the whipped water, the wild Ragosa. How much better to be a fisherman, to spend one's day in the midst of this. He thought of the PET scans he had studied, always looking for his mother, hands in his pockets, nodding as the radiologist spoke, and sometimes tears twinkling behind his lids. The enlargement of the amygdala, the increase in the white matter lesions, the severe depletion in the number of glial cells, the brains of the bipolar.
"But I'm not going to be a psychiatrist," he said.
The wind was really picking up now, making the ramp to the float bob up and down.
"I imagine you get a lot of wicky-wackies in that business,"
Mrs. Kittredge said, adjusting her feet, making a scraping sound as she moved them across the grit of the car floor.
"Some."
He had gone to medical school, thinking he'd become a pediatrician as his mother had been, but he had been drawn to psychiatry, in spite of his recognition that those who became psychiatrists did so as a result of their own messed-up childhoods, always looking, looking, looking for the answer in the writings of Freud, Horney, Reich, of why they were the anal, narcissistic, self-absorbed freaks that they were, and yet at the same time denying it, of course. What bullshit he had witnessed among his colleagues, his professors. His own interest had become narrowed to victims of torture, but that had also led him to despair. And when he had finally come under the care of Murray Goldstein, Ph.D., M.D., and had told the man his plans to work at The Hague with those whose feet had been beaten raw, whose bodies and minds lay in ruinous disorder, Dr. Goldstein had said,
"What, are you crazy?"
He'd been attracted to crazy. Clara, what a name, Clara Pilkington, appeared to be the sanest person he'd ever met. And wasn't that something? She ought to have been wearing a billboard around her neck, "Completely Crazy Clara."
"You know the old saying, I'm sure," Mrs. Kittredge said. "Psychiatrists are nutty. Cardiologists are hard-hearted."
He turned to look at her.
"And pediatricians?"
"Tyrants,"
Mrs. Kittredge acknowledged. She gave one shrug to her shoulder. Kevin nodded.
"Yeah,"
he said softly. After a moment, Mrs. Kittredge said,
"Well, your mother may not have been able to help it."
He was surprised. His urge to suck on his knuckles was like an agonizing itch, and he ran his hands back and forth over his knees, found the hole in his jeans.
"I think my mother was bipolar," he said. "Never diagnosed, though."
"I see."
Mrs. Kittredge nodded.
"She could have been helped today." "My father wasn't bipolar. He was depressed, and he never talked. Maybe they could have helped him today."
Kevin was silent, and maybe they couldn't, he thought.
"My son, he's got the depression."
Kevin looked at her. Small drops of perspiration had appeared in the pockets beneath her eyes. He saw that she did, in fact, look much older. Of course, she wouldn't look the same as she had back then, the seventh-grade math teacher that kids were scared of. He'd been scared of her, even while liking her.
"What's he do?"
Kevin asked.
"A podiatrist."
He felt the stain of some sadness make its way from her to him. Gusts of wind were now swooping in all directions, so that the bay looked like a blue and white, crazily frosted cake, peaks rising one way then another. Poplar leaves beside the marina were fluttering upward, their branches all bent to one side. I've thought of you, Kevin Coulson, she said. I have.
He closed his eyes. He could hear as she shifted her weight beside him, heard the gravel again on the rubber mat as her foot scraped over it. He was going to say, I don't want you thinking about me, when she said,
I liked your mother.
He opened his eyes. Patty Howe had stepped back out of the restaurant. She was walking toward the path in front of the place, and a nervousness touched his chest. It was sheer rock in front there, if he remembered right, a straight drop down, but she would know that.
I know you did,
Kevin said, turning to the big, intelligent face of Mrs. Kittredge.
She liked you.
Olive Kittredge nodded.
Smart. She was a smart woman.
He wondered how long this would have to go on, and yet it meant something to him that she had known his mother. In New York, no one knew.
Don't know if you know this or not, but that was the case with my father.
What was?
He frowned, passed his index knuckle briefly through his mouth.
Suicide?
He wanted her to leave. It was time for her to leave.
Are you married?
He shook his head.
No, my son isn't either. Drives my poor husband nuts. Henry wants everyone married, everyone happy. I say, for God's sake, let him take his time. Up here, the pickings can be slim. Down there in New York, I suppose you...
I'm not in New York.
Excuse me?
I'm not. I'm not in New York anymore.
He could hear that she was about to ask something. He thought he could almost feel her desire to turn around and look at the back seat, see what was in his car. If she did, he would have to say he needed to go, ask her to leave. He watched from the corner of his eye, but she was still looking straight ahead. Patty Howe, he saw, had shears in her hand. With her skirt blowing about her, she was standing by the rugosa, cutting some of the white blossoms. He kept his eye on Patty, the choppy bay spread out behind her.
How'd he do it?
He rubbed his hand over his thigh.
My father? Shot himself.
The moored sailboats now were heaving their bows high, then swooping back down as though pulled by an angry underwater creature. The white blossoms of the wild rugosa bent, straightened, bent again, the scraggly leaves around them bobbing as though they too were an ocean. He saw Patty Howe step back from them and give her hand a shake, as though she had been pricked by the thorns.
No note, Mrs. Kittredge said. Oh, Mother had such a hard time with that no note business. She thought the least he could have done was leave a note. The way he did if he'd walked to the grocery store. Mother would say, he was always considerate enough to leave me a note when he went anywhere. But he hadn't really gone anywhere. He was there in the kitchen, poor thing.
Do these boats ever get loose?
Kevin pictured his own childhood kitchen. He knew that a .22 caliber bullet could travel for 1 mile, go through 9 inches of ordinary board. But after the roof of a mouth, the roof of a house, after that, how far did it go?
Oh, sometimes. Not so much as you'd think, given how fierce these squalls can be. But every so often one does, you know, causes a ruckus. They have to go after it. Hope it doesn't smash up on the rocks.
Then the marina gets sued for malpractice?
He said this to divert her.
I don't know, Mrs. Kittredge said, how they handle that kind of thing. Different insurance arrangements, I guess. Acts of negligence or acts of God.
At the very moment Kevin became aware of liking the sound of her voice, he felt adrenaline pour through him, the familiar awful intensity, the indefatigable system that wanted to endure. He squinted hard toward the ocean. Great gray clouds were blowing in, and yet the sun, as though in contest, streamed yellow rays beneath them so that parts of the water sparkled with frenzied gaiety.
Unusual for a woman to use a gun,
Mrs. Kittredge said musingly. He looked at her. She did not return the look, just gazed out at the swirling incoming tide.
Well, my mother was an unusual woman, he said grimly.
Yes, Mrs. Kittredge said. She was.
When Patty Howe had gotten done with her shift, taken her apron off, and gone to hang it in the back room, she had seen through the dusty window the yellow daylilies that grew in the small patch of lawn on the far side of the marina. She pictured them in a jar next to her bed.
I'm disappointed, too,
her husband had said the second time, adding,
but I know it must feel like it happens just to you.
Her eyes moistened now, remembering this. A great swelling of love filled her. The lilies would not be missed. No one went to the far side of the marina, partly because the path that ran right in front was so narrow, the drop-off so steep. For insurance purposes, the place had recently posted a keep-out sign, and there was even talk of fencing it off before some small child, unwatched, scrambled off into the brush there. But Patty would just snip a few lilies and get going. She found the shears in a drawer and went out to get her bouquet, noticing when she stepped out that Mrs. Kittredge had joined Kevin Coulson in the car, and it gave her a feeling of safety having Mrs. Kittredge with him. She couldn't have said why and didn't dwell on it. The wind had picked up amazingly. She'd hurry and get her flowers, wrap them in a wet paper towel, and stop off by her mother's on the way home. She bent over the rugosa bushes first, thinking what a sweet combination the yellow and white would be. But they were alive in the wind, and her fingers were pricked. She turned to start along the path to where the lilies were. Kevin said,
Well, it was nice seeing you, Mrs. Kittredge.
He glanced at her with a nod meant to signal a goodbye. It was bad luck that she'd encountered him, but he could not be responsible for that. He had felt responsibility about Dr. Goldstein, whom Kevin had genuinely come to love, but even that had receded as he had driven up the turnpike. Olive Kittredge was taking a Kleenex from her big black bag. She touched it to her forehead, her hairline, didn't look at Kevin. She said,
I wish I hadn't passed those jeans on to him.
Kevin gave the slightest roll of his eyes. The question of genes, DNA, RNA, chromosome 6, the dopamine, serotonin crap. He'd lost interest in all that. In fact, it angered him the way a betrayal might. We are on the edge of understanding the essence of how the mind works in a molecular, real way, a noted academic had said at a lecture last year. The dawning of a new age. There was always a new age dawning.
Not that the kid didn't get a few wicky-wacky genes from Henry's side, God knows. His mother was a complete nut, you know. Horrid.
Whose mother?
Henry's. My husband's.
Mrs. Kittredge pulled out her sunglasses and put them on.
I guess you're not supposed to say nut these days, are you?
She looked over at him. He'd been about to start with his wrist again, but he put his hands back into his lap.
Please go, he thought. But she had 3 breakdowns and shock treatments. Doesn't that qualify?
He shrugged.
Well, she was wired funny. I guess I can at least say that.
Nuts was when you took a razor blade and cut long strips into your torso, your thighs, your arms. Completely crazy Clara. That was nuts. The first night together in the dark, he had felt the lines.
I fell,
she had whispered. He had pictured living with her. Art on the wall, light shining through a bedroom window, friends at Thanksgiving, a Christmas tree because Clara would want one.
The girl is nothing but trouble,
Dr. Goldstein had said. It was not Dr. Goldstein's place to say such a thing, but she had been nothing but trouble, loving and tender one minute, furious the next. The business of cutting herself, it had made him crazy. Crazy breeds crazy. And then she had left, because that's what Clara did, left people and everything else, off to somewhere new with her obsessions. She was crazy about the lunatic Carrie A. Nation, the first woman prohibitionist who had gone around chopping up saloons with hatchets and then selling the hatchets. "Is that the coolest thing you ever heard?" Clara had asked, sipping her soy milk. It was like that, cartwheeling from one thing to the next.
"Everyone suffers through a bad love affair," Dr. Goldstein had said.
That actually was just not true. Kevin knew people who had not suffered through a bad love affair. Not many, perhaps, but a few. Olive Kittredge blew her nose.
"Your son," Kevin said suddenly. "He's still able to practice?"
"What do you mean?"
"With his depression. He still goes to work every day?"
"Oh, sure." Mrs. Kittredge took off her sunglasses, gave him a quick, penetrating look.
"And Mr. Kittredge, is he well?"
"Yes, he is. He's thinking about retiring early. They sold the pharmacy, you know, and he'd have to work for the new chain, and they require all sorts of goofy regulations. Sad, the way the world is going." It was always sad the way the world was going, and always a new age dawning.
"What's your brother up to?"
Mrs. Kittredge asked. Kevin felt weary now. Maybe that was good.
"The last I knew, he was living on the streets of Berkeley. He's a drug addict."
Most of the time, Kevin didn't think of himself as having a brother.
"Where do you go after here? Texas? Is that what I remember? Your father took a job there."
Kevin nodded.
"I suppose he wanted to get as far away from here as possible. Time and distance, they always say. I don't know as that's true."
To get the conversation over with, Kevin said dully,
"My father died last year of liver cancer. He never remarried, and I never saw much of him once I left."
All the degrees Kevin had acquired, the colleges and universities he had gone to with the fellowships and scholarships he had received, his father had never showed up. But every town had been promising. Every place at first had said, "Here you go, you can live here. You can rest here. You can fit." The enormous skies of the Southwest, the shadows that fell over the desert mountains, the innumerable cacti, red-tipped or yellow-blossomed or flat-headed. All this had lightened him when he'd first moved to Tucson, taking hikes by himself, then with others from the university. Perhaps Tucson had been his favorite, had he been forced to choose. The stark difference between the open dustiness there and the ragged coastline here. But as with them all, the same hopeful differences, the tall, hot, white-glassed buildings of Dallas, the tree-lined streets of Hyde Park in Chicago with the wooden stairs behind each apartment, he had loved those especially, the neighborhoods of West Hartford where it looked like a storybook, the houses, the perfect lawns, they all became places that sooner or later, one way or another, assured him that he didn't, in fact, fit. When he got his medical degree from Chicago, attending the ceremony only because of one of his teachers, a kind woman who had said it would sadden her to have him not there, he sat beneath the full sun, listening to the president of the university say in his final words to them,
"To love and be loved is the most important thing in life,"
causing Kevin to feel an inward fear that grew and spread through him as though his very soul were tightening. But what a thing to say. The man in his venerable robe, white hair, grandfatherly face, he must have had no idea those words could cause such an exacerbation of the silent dread in Kevin. Even Freud had said, "We must love or we grow ill." They were spelling it out for him,
Every billboard, movie, magazine cover, television ad, it all spelled it out for him. We belong to the world of family and love, and you don't. New York, the most recent, had held the largest hopes. The subways filled with such a variety of dull colors and edgy-looking people, it relaxed him. The different clothes, the shopping bags, people sleeping or reading or nodding their heads to some earphoned tune. He had loved the subways, and for a while the activities of the hospitals. But his affair with Clara, and the end of it, had caused him to recoil from the place, so that the streets now seemed crowded and tiresome, all the same. Dr. Goldstein he loved, but that was it. Everyone else had become tiresome, and he had thought more and more how provincial New Yorkers were and how they didn't know it. What he began to want was to see his childhood house, a house he believed, even as he sat in this car now, that he had never once been happy in. And yet, oddly, the fact of its unhappiness seemed to have a hold on him with the sweetness of a remembered love affair. For Kevin had some memories of sweet, brief love affairs, so different from the long, drawn-out mess with Clara, and none measured up to the inner desire, the longing he felt for that place, that house where the sweatshirts and woolen jackets stank like moist salt and musty wood. The smell made him sick, as did the smell of a wood fire, which his father had sometimes made in the fireplace, poking at it in a distracted way. Kevin thought he must be the only person in the country who hated the smell of a wood fire. But the house, the trees tangled with woodbine, the surprise of a lady's slipper in the midst of pine needles, the open leaves of the wild lilies of the valley. He missed it. He missed his mother. "I've made this awful pilgrimage," he thought. "I've come back for more." Kevin wished, as he often did, that he had known the poet John Berryman. "When I was young," Mrs. Kittredge said, holding her sunglasses in her hand, "little, you know, I'd hide in the wood box when my father came home, and he'd sit down on the wood box and say, 'Where's Olive? Where can Olive be?' This would go on until I'd knock on the side and he'd act surprised. 'Olive,' he'd say, 'I had no idea where you were.' And I'd laugh and he'd laugh." Kevin looked over at her. She put her sunglasses on. She said, "I don't know how long that continued. Probably until I was too big to get into the wood box." He didn't know what to say to this. He squeezed his hands in as tiny a gesture as possible, looking down at the steering wheel. He felt her big presence and imagined, fleetingly, that an elephant sat next to him, one that wanted to be a member of the human kingdom, and sweet in an innocent way, as though her stubs of forelegs were folded on her lap, her trunk moving just a little as she finished speaking.
"That's a nice story," he said.
He thought of the boy cleaning the fish, how his father had held his hand out to him. He thought again of John Berryman. "Save us from shotguns and father's suicides. Mercy, do not pull the trigger, or all my life I'll suffer from your anger." He wondered if Mrs. Kittredge, being a math teacher, knew much poetry.
"Look how the wind's picked up," she said. "Always kind of exciting, long as you don't have a wharf that floats away like ours used to do. Henry'd be down on those rocks with the waves. Oh, God, what a fracas it was."
Again, Kevin found himself liking the sound of her voice. Through the windshield, he saw the waves coming in higher now, hitting the ledge in front of the marina, hard enough to send a spray far into the air, the spray then falling back languidly, the drops sifting through shards of sunlight that still cracked its way between the dark clouds.
The inside of his head began to feel as choppy as the surf before him.
"Don't go," his mind said to Mrs. Kittredge. "Don't go."
But this turbulence in him was torture. He thought how yesterday morning in New York, as he'd walked to his car, he had for one moment not seen it. And there was that prick of fear, because he'd had it all planned and wrapped up. And where was the car? But there it was, right there, the old Subaru wagon. And then he knew what he'd felt had been hope. Hope was a cancer inside him. He didn't want it. He did not want it. He could not bear these shoots of tender green hope springing up within him any longer. That awful story of the man who jumped and survived, walking back and forth for an hour on the Golden Gate Bridge, weeping, saying that had anyone stopped to ask why he was weeping, he wouldn't have jumped.
"Mrs. Kittredge, you have to..."
But she was leaning forward, squinting through the windshield.
"Wait, what in hell?"
And moving faster than he would have thought possible, she was out of the car, the door left open, and had gone to the front of the marina, her black bag left on the grass. For a moment she disappeared, then reappeared, waving her arms, shouting, though he couldn't hear what she was saying. He stepped from the car and was surprised by the force of the wind that whipped through his shirt. Mrs. Kittredge was shouting,
"Hurry up! Hurry!"
waving her arms like a huge seagull. He ran to where she was and looked down into the water, the tide higher than he'd have thought. Mrs. Kittredge pointed with a repeated thrust of her arm, and he saw the head of Patty Howe rise briefly above the choppy water, like a seal's head, her hair wet and darkened. And then she disappeared again, her skirt swirling with the swirling dark ropes of seaweed. Kevin turned so that as he slid down the high sheet of rock, his arms were spread as though to hug it. But there was nothing to hug, just the flat scraping against his chest, ripping his clothes, his skin, his cheek. And then the cold water rose over him. It stunned him how cold the water was, as though he'd been dropped into a huge test tube containing a pernicious chemical eating at his skin. His foot hit something steady in the massive swooshing of the water. He turned and saw her reaching for him, her eyes open, her skirt swirled around her waist. Her fingers reached for him, missed, reached for him again, and he got hold of her. The water receded for a moment, and as a wave came back to cover them, he pulled her hard, and her grip on him was so tight he would not have thought it possible with her thin arms that she could hold anything as tightly as she held him. Again the water rose. They both took a breath. Again they were submerged, and his leg hooked over something, an old pipe, unmoving. The next time, they both reached their heads high as the water rushed back, another breath taken. He heard Mrs. Kittredge yelling from above. He couldn't hear the words, but he understood that help was coming. He had only to keep Patty from falling away, and as they went again beneath the swirling, sucking water, he strengthened his grip on her arm to let her know he would not let her go. Even though, staring into her open eyes in the swirling, salt-filled water, with sun flashing through each wave, he thought he would like this moment to be forever. The dark-haired woman on shore calling for their safety, the girl who had once jumped a rope like a queen, now holding him with a fierceness that matched the power of the ocean. Oh, insane, ludicrous, unknowable world! Look how she wanted to live. Look how she wanted to hold on. The Piano Player. Four nights a week, Angela O'Meara played the piano in the cocktail lounge at the Warehouse Bar and Grill. The cocktail lounge, commodious and comfortable, with its sprawl of couches, plump leather chairs, and low tables, was right there as soon as you walked through the heavy doors of the old establishment. The dining room was farther back, with windows overlooking the water. Early in the week, the lounge tended to be rather empty, but by Wednesday night, and continuing straight through Saturday, the place was filled with people.
When you stepped from the sidewalk through the thick oak doors, there was the sound of piano notes, tinkling and constant, and the talk of the people who were slung back on their couches or sitting forward in their chairs or leaning over the bar seemed to accommodate itself to this, so the piano was not so much background music as it was a character in the room. In other words, the townspeople of Crosby, Maine, had for many years now taken into their lives the cocktail music and presence of Angie O'Meara. Angie, in her youth, had been a lovely woman to look at, with her wavy red hair and perfect skin, and in many ways this was still the case. But now she was into her 50s, and her hair, pinned back loosely with combs, was dyed a color you might consider just a little too red, and her figure, while still graceful, had a thickening of its middle, the more noticeable, perhaps, because she was otherwise quite thin. But she was long-waisted, and when she sat at the piano bench, she did so with the ease of a ballet dancer, albeit past her prime. Her jawline had gone soft and uneven, and the wrinkles near her eyes were quite pronounced, but they were kind wrinkles. Nothing harsh, it seemed, had happened to this face. If anything, her face revealed itself too clearly in a kind of simple expectancy no longer appropriate for a woman of her age. There was, in the tilt of her head, the slight messiness of the very bright hair, the open gaze of her blue eyes, a quality that could, in other circumstances, make people uncomfortable. Strangers, for example, who passed her in the Cook's Corner shopping mall were tempted to sneak an extra peek or two. As it was, Angie was a familiar figure to those who lived in town. She was just Angie O'Meara, the piano player, and she had been playing at the warehouse for many years. She had been in love with the town's first selectman, Malcolm Moody, for a number of years as well. Some people knew this, others did not. On this particular Friday night, Christmas was a week away, and not far from the baby grand piano stood a large fir tree heavily decorated by the restaurant's staff. Its silver tinsel swung slightly every time the door to the outside was opened, and different colored lights the size of eggs shone amidst the various balls and strings of popcorn and cranberries that adorned the slightly bent downward branches of the tree. Angie was wearing a black skirt and a pink nylon top that parted at her collarbone. And there was something about the tiny string of pearls she wore, and the pink top, and the bright red of her hair that seemed to glow along with the Christmas tree, as if she were some extension of its festivities. She had arrived, as she always did, at precisely 6 o'clock, smiling her vague, childlike smile, chewing on mints, saying hello to the bartender, Joe, and to Betty, the waitress, then tucking her handbag and coat near the end of the bar. Joe, a thick-set man who had tended that bar for many years and had the watchful eye of any good bartender, had come to the private conclusion that Angie O'Meara was really very frightened when she showed up at work each night. This would account for the whiff of booze on her minty breath, if you happened to be close enough to smell it. And it accounted for the fact that she never took her 20-minute break, although she was allowed to by the music union and encouraged to by the warehouse owner.
"I hate to get started again," she said to Joe one night, and that's when he put it together, that Angie must have suffered from stage fright.
If she suffered from anything more, it was considered nobody's business. It was the case with Angie that people knew very little about her, assuming at the same time that other people knew her moderately well. She lived in a rented room on Wood Street and did not own a car. She was within walking distance of a grocery store and also the warehouse bar and grill, a walk that took precisely 15 minutes in her black, very high-heeled shoes. In the winter, she wore very high-heeled black boots and a white fake fur coat and carried a little blue pocketbook. She could be seen picking her way carefully along the snow-covered sidewalks, then crossing through the big parking lot by the post office, and finally going down the little walkway toward the bay, where the squatty white clapboard warehouse sat. Joe was right when he imagined that Angie suffered from stage fright, and she had years ago learned to begin swallowing vodka at 5:15, so that by the time she left her room half an hour later, she had to hold the wall as she went down the hall stairs. But the walk cleared her head, while leaving her with enough confidence to make her way to the piano, open the keyboard, sit down, and play. What frightened her the most was the moment of those first notes, because that was when people really listened. She was changing the atmosphere in the room. It was the responsibility of this that frightened her, and it was why she played straight through for 3 hours without taking a break, in order to avoid the quiet that would fall over the room, to avoid again the way people smiled at her when she sat down to play. No, she didn't like the attention at all. What she liked was playing the piano. 2 bars into the first song, Angie was always happy. For her, it was as though she had slipped inside the music.
"We are one," Malcolm Moody used to say. "Let's become one, Angie. What do you say?"
Angie had never taken piano lessons, although people tended not to believe this, so she had stopped telling people this long ago. When she was 4 years old, she sat down at the piano in the church and began to play, and it didn't surprise her then or now. "My hands are hungry," she would say to her mother when she was young, and it was like that, a hunger. The church had given her mother a key, and these days Angie could still go there any time and play the piano. Behind her, she heard the door open, felt the momentary chill, saw the tinsel on the tree sway, and heard the loud voice of Olive Kittredge say,
"Too damn bad. I like the cold."
The Kittredges, when they came alone to the warehouse, tended to come early and did not sit in the lounge first, but went straight through to the dining room. Still, Henry would always call out,
"Evening there, Angie,"
smiling broadly on his way through, and Olive would wave her hand over her head in a kind of hello. Henry's favorite song was "Good Night, Irene," and Angie would try to remember to play this later as the Kittredges walked back through on their way out. Lots of people had favorite songs, and Angie would sometimes play them, but not always. Henry Kittredge was different. She always played his song, because whenever she saw him, it was like moving into a warm pocket of air. Tonight, Angie was shaky. There were nights now when her vodka did not do what it had done for many years, which was to make her happy and make everything feel pleasantly at a distance. Tonight, as sometimes happened now, she felt a little queer in the head, off kilter. She made sure to keep a smile on her face and didn't look at anyone except Walter Dalton, who sat at the end of the bar. He blew her a kiss. She winked, a tiny gesture. You would have thought it was a blink, except she did it with only one eye. There was a time when Malcolm Moody loved to see her blink like that.
"God, but you get me going,"
he'd say on those afternoons he came to her room on Wood Street. Malcolm did not like Walter Dalton and referred to him as a fairy, which he was. Walter was also an alcoholic, and the college had let him go, and now he lived in a house on Coombs Island. Walter came into the bar every night that Angie played. Sometimes he brought her a gift, a silk scarf once, a pair of leather gloves with tiny buttons on the side. He always handed his car keys to Joe, and then, after closing, Joe often drove him home, with one of the busboys driving Joe's car to give Joe a drive back.
"What a pathetic life,"
Malcolm had said to Angie about Walter.
"Sitting there every night, getting stewed."
Angie didn't like to have people called pathetic, but she didn't say anything. Sometimes, not often, Angie would think that people might call her life with Malcolm pathetic, This would occur to her as she walked down a sunny sidewalk, or it might happen when she woke in the night. It made her heart race, and she would go over in her mind the kinds of things he had said to her over the years. At first he had said,
"I think about you all the time."
He still said,
"I love you."
Sometimes,
"What would I do without you, Angie?"
He never bought her gifts, and she wouldn't have wanted him to. She heard the street door open and close, felt the brief chill from the outdoors once again. From the corner of her eye, she caught the motion of a man in a dark coat sinking into a chair in the far corner, and there was something in the way he ducked or moved that ever so slightly jogged her mind. But she was shaky tonight.
"Dear,"
she whispered to Betty, who was moving past with a tray of glasses, "could you tell Joe I need a little Irish coffee?"
"Sure,"
said Betty, a nice girl, small as a child.
"No problem."
She drank it with one hand, still playing the notes of "Have a Holly Jolly Christmas," and gave a wink to Joe, who nodded gravely. At the end of the night, she would have a drink with Joe and Walter, and she would tell them about visiting her mother in the nursing home today. She might or might not mention the bruises on her mother's arm.
"A request, Angie."
Betty dropped a cocktail napkin on her way past while she held the tray of drinks in the flat of her uplifted hand. You could see how heavy it was for her by the way she swayed her back as she moved around the chairs.
"From that man,"
she added, moving her head toward the corner. "Bridge over troubled water" was written on the napkin, and Angie kept playing Christmas carols, smiling her smile. She did not look at the man in the corner. She played every Christmas carol she could think of, but she was not inside the music now. Perhaps another drink would help. But the man in the corner was watching, and he would know it was not coffee alone in the cup Betty brought her. His name was Simon. He had once been a piano player, too. "Fall on your knees, oh, hear the angel voices." But it was like she had fallen overboard and had to swim through seaweed. The darkness of the man's coat seemed to press against her head, and there was a watery terror that had to do with her mother. "Get inside," she thought, but she was very shaky. She slowed down, played the first Noel quite lightly. She saw a large, snowy field now with a crack of gentle light along the horizon. When she finished, she did something that really surprised her. Later, she had to wonder how long she had been planning this without quite knowing, the way she didn't quite allow herself to know when Malcolm had stopped saying, "I think about you all the time." Angie took a break. Delicately, she pressed the cocktail napkin to her lips, slipped out from behind the piano, and walked toward the restroom where there was a payphone. She did not want to bother Joe for her pocketbook.
"Darling," she said quietly to Walter, "do you have some change?"
He stretched out a leg, reached into his pocket, handed her the coins.
"You're the candy shop, Angie,"
Walter said slurringly. His hand was moist. Even the coins felt moist.
"Thank you, sweetheart,"
she said. She went to the phone and dialed Malcolm's number. Not once in 22 years had she called him at home, although she had memorized his number long ago. 22 years, she thought, as she listened to the buzz of the ring, would be considered a very long time by most people. But for Angie, time was as big and round as the sky, and to try to make sense of it was like trying to make sense of music and God and why the ocean was deep. Long ago, Angie had known not to try to make sense of these things the way other people tried to do. Malcolm answered the phone, and there was a curious thing. She didn't like the sound of his voice.
"Malcolm," she said softly, "I can't see you anymore. I'm so terribly sorry, but I can't do this anymore."
Silence. His wife was probably right there.
"Bye now,"
she said. On her way past Walter, she said,
"Thank you, darling."
and he said,
"Anything for you, Angie."
Walter's voice was thick with drunkenness, his face glistening. She played the song Simon wanted then, Bridge Over Troubled Water, but it wasn't until she was almost through that she allowed herself to look at him. He did not return her smile, and a flush went through her. She smiled at the Christmas tree. The colored lights seemed terribly bright, and for a moment she felt baffled that people did this to trees, decorated them with all that glitter. Some people looked forward to this all year. And then another flush of heat rose through her to think how in a few weeks the tree would be stripped, taken down, hauled out onto the sidewalk with tinsel still sticking to it. She could picture how awkward this tree would look, perched sideways on the snow, its chopped little trunk sticking at an angle in the air. She began to play We Shall Overcome, but someone from the bar called out,
"Hey, a little serious there, Angie."
And so she smiled even more brightly and played Ragtime instead. Stupid to play that, to play We Shall Overcome. Simon would think it was stupid. She realized that now.
"You're so schmaltzy," he used to say,
but he had said other things when he took her to lunch with her mother that first time.
"You're like a person in a beautiful fairy tale," he had said, sunlight falling across the table on the deck. "You're the perfect daughter," he had said, out in the rowboat in the bay, her mother waving from the rocks. "You have the face of an angel," he said the day they stepped from the boat onto Puckerbrush Island. Later, he sent her one white rose. Oh, she had been just a girl. She had come into this very bar with her friends one night that summer, and there he was playing Fly Me to the Moon. It was like he'd had little lights flickering off him. A nervous fellow, though, Simon had been, his whole body jerking around like a puppet pulled by strings. A lot of force in his playing, but it lacked, well, deep in her heart she had known even then that his playing lacked, well, feeling. "Play feelings," people sometimes requested then, but he never did. "Too corny," he said, "too schmaltzy."
He had come up from Boston just for the summer, but stayed 2 years. When he broke it off with Angie, he said,
"It's like I have to date both you and your mother. Gives me the creeps."
Later he wrote to her,
"You're neurotic."
He wrote,
"You're wounded."
She couldn't use the pedal. Her leg was shaking beneath her black skirt. He was the only person she'd ever told that her mother had taken money from men. A burst of laughter came from the bar, and Angie looked over, but it was just some of the fishermen telling stories with Joe. Walter Dalton smiled sweetly at her, rolled his eyes toward the fishermen. Her mother had knit the three of them matching blue sweaters for Christmas. When her mother left the room, Simon said,
"We will never wear these at the same time."
Her mother bought him a whole stack of Beethoven records. When Simon left, her mother wrote and asked him for the records back, but he didn't send them. Her mother said they could still wear the blue sweaters, and when her mother wore the blue sweater, she had Angie wear hers as well. Her mother said to her one day, "Simon got rejected from music school, you know. He's a real estate lawyer in Boston. Bob Bean bumped into him down there." "Okay," Angie had said. She thought then she wouldn't see him again, because she had seen a shadow of envy flicker darkly over his face the day she'd told him. Oh, she had told him everything, child that she was in that shack with her mother. How once, when she was 15, a man from Chicago had heard her play at a local wedding. He ran a music school and had talked with her mother for 2 days. Angie should be at the school. There would be a scholarship, room and board. "No," Angie's mother had said, "she's mommy's girl." But for years, Angie had pictured the place, a white, sprawling place where young people played the piano all day. She would be taught by kind men and women. She would learn to read music. All the rooms would be heated. There would be none of the sounds that came from her mother's room, sounds that made her push her hands to her ears at night, sounds that made her leave the house and go to the church to play the piano. But no, Angie's mother had decided she was Mommy's girl. She glanced again at Simon. He was leaning back in his chair, watching her. There was no pocket of warmth the way there was whenever Henry Kittredge walked through the door, or the way there was right now at the bar where Walter sat. What was it he had come to see? She pictured him leaving a law office early, driving up the coast in the dark. Perhaps he was divorced, having the kind of crisis men often had in their late 50s, looking back over their lives, wondering why things had worked out the way they had. And so he, after how many years, had thought, or not thought, of her, but for some reason had driven to Crosby, Maine. Had he known she would be working here? From the corner of her eye, she saw him rise, and there he was, leaning against the open baby grand, looking straight at her. He had lost most of his hair.
"Hello, Simon," she said. She was playing stuff she'd made up now, her fingers going over the keys.
"Hello, Angie."
He wasn't a man you'd look twice at now. Probably back then he wasn't a man you'd have looked twice at, but that didn't matter the way people thought it did. It didn't matter how once he'd had an ugly brown leather jacket and thought it was cool. You couldn't make yourself stop feeling a certain way, no matter what the other person did. You had to just wait. Eventually the feeling went away because others came along. Or sometimes it didn't go away, but got squeezed into something tiny and hung like a piece of tinsel in the back of your mind. She was slipping into the music now.
"How are you, Simon?" she said, smiling.
"Very well, thanks."
He gave a small nod.
"Quite well."
And then she felt the ping of danger. His eyes were not warm. They had been warm eyes.
"I see you still have your red hair," he said.
"I put a rinse through it these days, I'm afraid."
He just looked at her. His coat hung loosely. His clothes had always hung loosely.
"Are you still a lawyer, Simon? I heard you were a lawyer."
He nodded.
"The truth is, Angie, I'm good at it. It's nice to be good at something."
"Yes, of course it is. What kind of law?"
"Real estate."
He looked down, but he raised his chin in a moment.
"It's fun, like a puzzle."
"Oh, well, that's nice."
She crossed her left hand over, did a light run.
"Ever marry, Angie?"
"No. No, I didn't. And you?"
She had already seen the wedding ring, a broad band. She would not have thought him the type to wear such a broad band.
"Yes, I have 3 children, 2 boys and a girl, all grown."
He shifted his feet, still leaning against the piano.
"Oh, lovely, Simon, that's lovely."
She had forgotten "O Come All Ye Faithful." She began playing that, her fingers reaching deeply into it. Sometimes when she played, it was like being a sculptress, she thought, pulling at the lovely, thick clay. He looked at his watch.
"You're off at 9, then?"
"I am, yes, but I have to skedaddle right out of here, I'm afraid, sorry to say."
She had stopped blushing. Her skin felt chilly now. She had quite a headache.
"Okay, Angie."
He stood up straight.
"I'll be taking off. Nice to see you after all these years."
"Yes, Simon, nice to see you."
Betty's arm placed a cup of coffee down on the other side.
"From Walter,"
Betty said, moving past. Angie turned her head, gave Walter that small blink of a wink. Walter, watching her, bleary in his eyes. Simon was walking away, and there were the Kittredges, leaving, Henry waving his hand. "Good night, Irene," she played. Simon turned back. In two jerky motions, he was at her side, leaning his face next to hers.
You know, your mother came to Boston to see me.
Angie's face got very warm.
She took the Greyhound bus, said Simon's voice in her ear, and then took a taxi to my apartment. When I let her in, she asked for a drink and started taking off her clothes, unbuttoned that button slowly at the top of her neck.
Angie's mouth had gone dry,
and I've been feeling pretty sorry for you, Angie, all these years.
She smiled straight ahead of her. Good night, Simon, she said. She drank with one hand all the Irish coffee, and then she played all sorts of songs. She didn't know what she played, couldn't have said, but she was inside the music, and the lights on the Christmas tree were bright and seemed far away. Inside the music like this, she understood many things. She understood that Simon was a disappointed man if he needed, at this age, to tell her he had pitied her for years. She understood that as he drove his car back down the coast toward Boston, toward his wife with whom he had raised three children, that something in him would be satisfied to have witnessed her the way he had tonight, and she understood that this form of comfort was true for many people, as it made Malcolm feel better to call Walter Dalton a pathetic fairy. But it was thin milk, this form of nourishment. It could not change that you had wanted to be a concert pianist and ended up a real estate lawyer, that you had married a woman and stayed married to her for 30 years when she did not ever find you lovely in bed. The lounge was mostly empty now, and warmer since the door wasn't being opened all the time. She played We Shall Overcome. She played it twice, slowly, grandly, and looked over at the bar to where Walter was smiling at her. He raised a fist into the air.
Want a ride there, Angie?
Joe asked as she closed the top of the piano, went and gathered her coat and pocketbook.
No, thank you, dear,
she said as Walter helped her into her white fake fur coat.
The walk will do me good.
Clutching her little blue pocketbook, she picked her way over the snowbank by the sidewalk, across the parking lot of the post office. The green numbers by the bank said -3 degrees, but she didn't feel cold. Her mascara was frozen, though. Her mother had taught her not to touch her eyelashes when it was this cold or they could break off. Turning onto Wood Street, the street lamps pale in the dark cold, she said out loud,
"Huh,"
because she was baffled by many things. That often happened after being inside the music the way she'd been tonight. She stumbled a little with her high-heeled boots, put her hand against the porch rail.
Cunt!
She had not seen him standing beside the house in the dark shadow from the overhang.
You cunt, Angie!
He stepped toward her.
Malcolm,
she said softly.
Now, please.
Calling my house. Who the fuck do you think you are?
Well,
she said. She pressed her lips together, put a finger to her mouth.
Well, she said, let's see.
It was not her style to call his house, but even less so to remind him that she, in 22 years, had never done so before.
You're a fucking nut, he said, and you're a drunk, too.
He walked away. She saw his truck parked on the next block.
You call me at work when you sober up, he said over his shoulder.
And then more quietly,
and don't go pulling this shit again.
Even drunk, she knew she would not call him when she sobered up. She let herself into the apartment house and sat down on the stairwell. Angela O'Meara, a face like an angel. A drunk. Her mother sold herself to men.
Never married Angela.
But sitting on the stairwell, she told herself that she was no more, no less pathetic than any of them, including Malcolm's wife. And people were kind. Walter, Joe, and Henry Kittredge. Oh, definitely, there were kind people in the world.
Tomorrow she would get to work early and tell Joe about her mother and the bruises.
Imagine, she would say to Joe, imagine someone pinching an old, paralyzed woman like that.
Angie, leaning her head now against the hallway wall, fingering her black skirt, felt she had figured something out too late, and that must be the way of life, to get something figured out when it was too late. Tomorrow she would go play the piano in the church, stop thinking about the bruises on her mother's upper arm, that thin arm with its slack, soft skin, so loose from the bone that when you squeezed it in your fingers, it was hard to imagine it could feel anything. A little burst. 3 hours ago, while the sun was shining full tilt through the trees and across the back lawn, the local podiatrist, a middle-aged man named Christopher Kittredge, was married to a woman from out of town named Suzanne. This is the first marriage for both of them, and the wedding has been a smallish, pleasant affair with a flute player and baskets of yellow sweetheart roses placed inside and outside the house. So far, the polite cheerfulness of the guests